Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining me is Phil Kirpin from American Commitment, AmericanCommitment.org. And Phil and I are going to talk a little bit about the second term agenda of Donald Trump on a day where it feels like we've already seen it all this week, Phil.
I mean, it's not even a week yet. Ed, it's not even a week yet. And we've got, you know, we've got the hiring freeze. We've got the back to work order, the regulation freeze, the pause on all foreign aid, the First Amendment executive order, the reversal of all the anti-energy regulations, the withdrawing from the Paris Climate Treaty and the World Health Organization and the OECD tax cartel. And overturning 60 years of affirmative action.
I was just about to mention that, which was really not on anybody's radar, right?
I don't know how I forgot that one. That should probably be number one of the whole list. I think because that one came day two. The ones I said were day one. So he saved sort of that big bomb for day two. Pretty amazing what we've already seen. Of course, you know, it's one thing to issue an executive order telling agencies to do these things. It's another thing for them actually to be implemented. And of course, you know, if you don't go through all the procedural steps, you lose in court. And so all of these things are easier said than done. But boy, they were much more prepared from a policy and substance standpoint than last. I didn't even mention any of the border stuff also. I mean, they were much more prepared this time than they were 8 years ago. No question.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on that point, just briefly, I'll say this, is that, all the stuff that took place after the election in 2016, in terms of the Russia collusion thing, probably interfered a lot with the ability to transition. But I also think that Donald Trump just really didn't understand what the job was then. He certainly understands it now. And he was prepared, unlike any other president I've ever seen, on day one. I mean, this is a huge shift in paradigms. And, you know,
Ed, think about it like this. He spent 4 years thinking that he should be president, watching things happen, thinking all the things that he would be doing. And he was having people write him up and getting prepared. And I think this transition team this time that was led by Howard Lutnick and Linda McMahon, this was night and day to what Chris Christie and his people did last time. And part of it, of course, is that they were already talking about impeachment and they were doing Russia Gate and dossier and, you know, entrapping Flynn and all of that stuff. But to your point, a lot of it is just much better preparation and much better understanding of the job and of the needs of staffing and really surrounding himself with the right people this time. And he's hit the ground running in a pretty incredible way. I mean, I'm not sure the guy slept at all this week based on the amount of time that he spent more time on camera in his first week than I think Biden did in the last year. I mean, it's incredible the amount that we've seen. And of course, you know, but to me, the big question mark and the big thing that sort of hangs over the success of this presidential term and certainly of this first year is, you know, will he be able to get the tax cuts through Congress? Because that's the one thing that he absolutely cannot do on his own accord. No executive order or agency action or regulation is going to prevent this massive tax hike that we're staring at the end of this year. And, you know, all of the Trump tax cuts on the individual side expire if we hit the end of this calendar year. And that means about a $3,000 per household tax hike. That's going to derail and, you know, that's going to overwhelm the benefit of almost all the stuff that he's doing administratively if it's not prevented. And so he's got to figure out how to get that done. He's talking about doing this one big, beautiful bill loaded with all, you know, the energy provisions and the border stuff he wants and everything else, along with tax and trying to get to his desk by Memorial Day. But there's no margin for error in the House. And we've got basically a one seat majority at the moment. It'll go back to three after these Florida special elections, but it's almost no margin at all. It's like the House has become the Senate now. Just a couple of guys can stop anything. And so he's really going to be put to the test. And, you know, he's already met one-on-one with half the House Republicans. Now, I don't know how he did that when he's done all the other things that we've seen him do this week. This is why I think the guy doesn't sleep. But he understands that if he doesn't get tax done and done early, then we're going to have a weak economy going into the election next year. It's going to be a disaster for him politically. So that's the aspect of his agenda where he really needs Congress. But on everything else, he's moving pretty much full steam ahead right now.
Well, you know, and Phil, I mean, this is one of the things I think is just the energy of this administration has been tremendous. He's flying out to I think he flew to North Carolina and then he's going someplace else and then California. It's first time back on Air Force One in 4 years. And so he's going to disaster sites and he's talking about, you know, dismantling FEMA. Not necessarily sure I'm crazy about that idea. I think reforming it is a great idea. I'm not necessarily sure that there isn't a role for the federal government to coordinate.
Ed, can we fire the people who said they were skipping houses with Trump signs?
Yes, absolutely.
But I don't believe it was just that one woman.
No. That she's the scapegoat. I mean, she certainly did that, but she was ordered to, you know, those orders came from on high. And yes. So like I said, massive reform, I get, because it's also just been incompetent. No, I mean, even beyond that, even beyond the politicization, it just really hasn't been competent. And this brings us into, you know, what it is that he's going to do. He's already basically furloughed all of the DEI functions in these in federal agencies, which is what he promised to do. He has eliminated the legal basis for affirmative action because that was apparently entirely contained in that Lyndon Johnson EO from 1965.
And subsequent EOs, but it was all executive. I don't know how, the liberals are going to cook up something, but I don't know how you can go into court and say an executive order can't overturn other executive orders, which is basically
They tried that with DACA, right? And what the court ended up saying with DACA was that there was a reliance factor that the Trump administration needed to work out in order to repeal it. And they didn't get a chance to because, of course, the term ran out and Joe Biden re-strengthened DACA. And, of course, Democrats were trying to get it put into statute after that, which is one of the reasons why, you know.
But remember, the weakest Republican appointee on the Supreme Court, John Roberts, is actually quite good on racial preferences. And so yeah. I think that this is likely to be upheld.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. And because they were already going in that direction, right? In two different cases, they had dismantled affirmative action structures. And so
what's the Roberts quote? The best way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race.
Exactly. And he's right. And he's actually written that twice. He wrote something similar, I think 20 years or 15 years earlier, warning that they were dealing with it and they were going to let it slide. But he warned that the court was not going to let that go forever. And that the only way to stop is the exact same type of sentiment. He put it maybe slightly differently, but pretty close to the same thing. And so he was kind of quoting himself in that. And he's right. And so, rather than just review all the really interesting things that have happened this week, what do you think the broader agenda items are going to be? What should we be looking for? We just do a few minutes on that.
Well, I mean, I think at least from the economic standpoint, which is really what I focus on, there's sort of three core elements to getting, a prosperous economic environment. You've got to have, you've got to cut back on regulation. And we're seeing that in a major big bang way this week. I didn't even mention, I think, that he's going to repeal the EV mandates, which are the most expensive regulation in world history. That was in one of the executive orders. Now, of course, the executive order saying get rid of it doesn't mean it's gotten rid of. You need to go through the rulemaking at EPA. There's a whole process. And if you miss any steps, you lose in court. And so, this stuff doesn't just happen with the snap of the fingers. But, the regulatory environment needs to be favorable to risk taking and investment and capital formation and job creation. And so we need to have huge dial back in regulation. Biden put about $50,000 per household in new regulatory costs in his 4 years on a net present value basis. It's by far the highest of any president in history. And, about half of it, a little more than half, is the EV mandate. That's how insane they are and just the scale of that. So dialing back regulation is a huge part of it. Low taxes are critical. That's where he's going to really need to, buckle down and basically get every Republican in Congress in line. That's going to be a heavy lift, but it's absolutely critical. And the later in the year we go, the worse the economic damage, even if they ultimately get it extended, because you get a lot of businesses that are taking a wait and see, that don't know what the tax environment is going to be for next year. And therefore, the further we get into the year, the more damage it does, even if they ultimately get that done. So I really hope they'll get that done by Memorial Day, which was the deadline the president set. And then, of course, the hardest one of all, the one we never get right, is spending cuts. Because if we don't cut spending, you look at the fiscal outlook and the debt burden, and, we're going to get, the inflationary episode we had from all the COVID spending in the last couple of years will be the chronic reality every year if we don't change the fiscal trajectory. And so I'm really hoping Senator Ron Johnson is chairing the budget this time. He says that they're going to go dial things back to pre-COVID spending levels. I would love to see it. I would love to see it. We always talk about spending cuts and we never seem to get it done. And when Trump came in his first term, Mick Mulvaney wrote probably the best federal budget that I've ever seen. And Mitch McConnell went to the president and said, nobody's ever lost a re-election from not spending enough. Nobody's ever lost re-election from spending too much, but they lose if they don't spend enough and throw this budget out and spend. We need the money to flow if you want to win. And Trump, who at the time, you know, he had just come to Washington, he didn't know. He's got the head of the Republicans in the Senate saying, throw Mick Mulvaney's budget in the garbage and just let spending run wild. And that's basically what he did. He did not fight for spending cuts in his first term. And I think that he regrets that. I think he regrets signing those omnibus bills that he signed. And I think that the fact that he's putting Russ Vote back at OMB, who's talked about being very aggressive on spending, is a really good indicator that they are going to fight for spending cuts this time. And the other thing to really watch on spending, which could be an opportunity to really get some significant spending cuts, is that OMB has brought back Trump has brought back Mark Pauletta to be general counsel at OMB. And Mark spent the last 4 years developing this legal theory and memos and research and so forth to back it up, that the Impoundment Control Act of 1974 is unconstitutional. And I don't know ultimately where the courts are going to come down on that, but if they win, that changes everything on spending, because pre-1974, congressional appropriations were ceilings, but presidents didn't have to spend that much if they could accomplish the purpose of an appropriation for less. So in other words, pre-1974, if Congress said, we're appropriating $100 million for a bridge, but the president could build it for $47 million, he didn't have to spend the other 53. Gets returned to the Treasury, doesn't get spent. Post-1974, the president is required as a matter of law to spend every penny that Congress appropriates, even if it's total waste, even if the purpose of the appropriation could have been accomplished for much less. They're going to argue that there's an inherent constitutional power of the president to spend just what's necessary to accomplish the purpose of an appropriation and no more than that. And I don't know where, you know, we'll see. But if they win that argument in court, we could get major spending even without convincing Congress potentially. So that's definitely something to watch also.
Well, I think you're right about that. I would note, though, that Donald Trump, he's talked about spending. So I know that's on the radar. I know that's part of the intent. And you're right. Personnel is policy. And you take a look at the personnel, Russ Vote and Mark Pauletta at OMB, and you see that that's the direction that things are going in. I would caution, though, of course, that Donald Trump is famously a fan of debt. I mean,
well, famously, he does love playing with debt, but we might be near even his limits because the debt burden is substantial and grows as far as the eye can see. And of course, you know, but this also speaks to the other things we're talking about with taxes and regulation, right? Because, you know, one of the ways that you handle a debt load, if you can, is you raise your income, right? And then the debt payments that you have to make are much more manageable. And you can do that on the national level by raising the economic growth rate. And that's why it's so important that whatever else we do, the tax cuts get extended. Because if we fail to do that, it's going to destroy millions of jobs and billions of dollars in investment, be a major hit to GDP. And that makes the debt much less manageable. And so this view that we're seeing from a handful of Republicans, I'm actually pretty worried about that, we can't afford to extend the tax cuts. I think it's kind of backwards. We can't afford not to, because we've got to have a strong economic growth environment to make the debt manageable.
Well, yes. And I agree. I mean, I'm a fiscal hawk, right? So yeah. To get there, though, to really get there, you have to be willing to re-engineer the entitlement programs. And that means Social Security, that means Medicare. And look, I mean, the guy has... the guy's got gonads of steel this week.
Yeah.
And it's easy to imagine.
I think they're going to focus a lot. I think they're going to focus a lot on Medicaid in terms of replacing it with a block grant and giving the states a lot more flexibility to run it, and also work requirements. Remember, we had a huge number of able-bodied working age adults with no dependents who were put on the Medicaid rolls in Obamacare. And they did that with no work requirements. And so a lot of people now get health care who are not working when they should be working. They're sitting around playing video games or on drugs or whatever it is. And, you know, we've got to, if we get tough with those people, the same as we did for cash welfare in the 90s, it's actually to their benefit. If we say, hey, you know, if you want health care, and I think we should do the same thing for housing subsidies and, you know, all the other federal welfare programs, we basically say, you want to be in these programs, that's great, but you're either going to get a job or you're going to be in a qualified job training, because we don't want you on these programs forever. We want you to get off of them and get on the ladder of economic opportunity and get your healthcare from your employer and not need Medicaid. And, you know, I think that if we do that, it will be win-win. the same way welfare reform was in the 90s, that will actually, in, you know, the Democrats and the media will go, oh my God, you're cutting benefits for poor people. You hate them. You want to die. And we say, no. We're helping them not need them anymore by getting the incentives right, by saying we're going to require work or qualified job training. So I think that's going to be a big part of what they do on spending, and it's going to be win-win. And you can do that for Medicaid. Medicare is much tougher, but there certainly are reforms that we can make. I really hope that they go for site-neutral payments. This is something we were unable to get done so far, but this is what's driven all this consolidation in the hospital system. They keep buying up physician practices because Medicare will pay you more for the identical doctor's visit if your doctor's office is part of a hospital system. Even if it's the same office and the same doctor, he gets bought by a hospital system, and now Medicare pays a much higher payment amount. That's crazy. Yes. That's insane.
Well, you and I have talked about that before, and I've talked about that with some other medical providers too. It's huge. It's a huge issue, and they should really be addressing that. We're going to need to wrap this up, but I do want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about American Commitment, AmericanCommitment.org, and what it is that you guys are focusing on over there.
Yeah, I mean, usually it's the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues and all the kinds of things we've been talking about, although we did just start a petition to amend the Constitution to get rid of lame duck pardons, because I was so incensed at what we just saw from Biden. And I don't understand why for months after somebody's, you know, after he's passed the election, he can pardon his family and Anthony Fauci and all these other people. So I would like, I don't know how anyone could oppose that amendment, but, you know, I'm sure people.
Well, I'll just throw this out at you, and you guys can over at AmericanCommitment.org can chew on this. I actually think that there should be a constitutional amendment that requires that it puts in place some sort of congressional check on the presidential pardons, whether that, states have structures like this, right?
Where I wouldn't necessarily mind that, Ed. I just think it's so hard to amend the Constitution. I think we're going to do it to something absolutely no one could oppose. And if you just say no pardons starting 30 days before the election through the inauguration of the next president, which is a proposal from Professor Stephen Sachs, how could anyone oppose that?
Well, I'm okay with that, but I think if you give the power to Congress, you're going to get a lot more votes in Congress to pass that amendment.
Well, that's a good point. Congress loves their own power, that's for sure.
Congress loves their own power. And look, the proper check on presidential power is Congress, right? So why not put that? I mean, you certainly can have that same limit in there too. You could do both at the same time. No presidential pardons. After 30 days prior to an election, presidential election, plus Congress has the right to review and to overturn any clemency actions that presidents issue. You know, maybe you make it a 2/3 vote or something like that. But
I like it. I like it.
Yeah. So
you know, it's one of the only things we have where there's not a check and balance. So
it's true. It's true. So there you go. I have just contributed to AmericanCommitment.org, sort of. So go over there and check it out. Phil's going to work on that right now. He's going to call it the Ed Morrissey Constitutional Amendment. I'm just telling you that right now. Right, Phil? Is that right?
If we add your provision, we will call it that.
Oh, that's obviously we're kidding around here. But I think it's a good idea. I'm glad that you guys are looking at that particular issue, and I hope that you press it. Phil Kirpin, AmericanCommitment.org, at Kirpin on Twitter still, right?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of an addict on there. So if people want my up to the second thoughts, you can see it on there.
There you go. All right, Phil, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Have a good one, Ed.
You too.